Thank you guys for having me. Thanks, Bob, for the opportunity to come. I was just thinking about Wisconsin. If we just get the cows to vote in Wisconsin, we'd win.
Get them registered.
That's right. Get our friends. Well, first of all, it's kind of dangerous to let a manure guy come and present because you never really know what's going to happen. But you can relax. There will be no bull in today's talk. I want to thank Jerry Hood. Where's Jerry Hood? Raise your hand, Jerry Hood. He's the former executive director of the CSPMA. Aside from being a great guy, he has been an excellent resource for some of what you'll hear today. So if you don't like something I say, you can talk to Jerry Hood about it later. Manure, of course, is nothing new. In fact, it's far from new. From the creation of the very first animal, there's been manure. It was certainly the agrarian's first fertilizer, and it's been used for practical applications like fuel and even buildings ever since. Many of us in the manure management industry believe we're entering a new point in our civilized world where we will be required to manage large amounts of animal manure like never before. Just like we've evolved from throwing our garbage into the creek or gully to now using sophisticated landfills, manure is certainly trending down a similar path. The latest technology, anaerobic digestion, has shown some potential. So here we are in 2012 in the midst of a manure revolution. So a little bit about our company, Organics Incorporated. We were founded in 2001. We're based in Walla Walla, Washington. We serve about 20 dairies, representing about 50,000 cows in Yakima County, which is a very densely populated milk-producing area. We specialize in the production and sales of dairy-based soil amendments. We sell to orchards, vineyards, row crop farms, landscape supply, and nurseries. As of 2012, we figured we've processed or sold over 4 billion pounds of treated dairy manure. But that sounds so small compared to like 16 trillion, doesn't it? The current primary focus revolves around our patented post-digester process that converts dairy digester residual solids into repeat. And we've also launched a new system called the A2 anaerobic to aerobic digester. We won't talk much about that today. So there's 9.2 million milk cows in the United States. Each one of them produces about 75 pounds of milk per day. That's just a lot of milk. And when you think about this group here, I'm just out of a show of hands, how many of you have something in your hand that has a milk product in it? Cream, right? Cream or something like that? Good. So right this very second in this room, milk is taking place. Those same 9.2 million milk cows in the U.S. produce 140 pounds of manure every day. That's a lot of manure, and exactly it's 644,000 tons per day, every day. Just a lot of material. So this is your milk cow, weighs about 3/4 of a ton. And I wanted to put this in kind of a context where you could say, what can we compare this to? I mean, we've got this land animal that produces all of this manure, and I thought, what's another land animal that produces a lot of manure? And
member of Congress.
Close. Not the right side of a member of Congress. But an elephant. An elephant produces about 300 pounds per day, which is basically twice what a dairy cow produces, but it weighs 6 tons or 8 times more. This means that every state would have about 92,000 elephants if we took all the manure of the dairy cows and spread it over the United States. So this is a big, and some people would say this is a big problem. I don't really see it as a big problem. I see it as a big issue or a big item, but in no way is this necessarily a big problem. So manure absolutely produces issues that have to be addressed. And this is the list that I come up with, and there's probably a lot more. Odor, that's an easy one. Everyone knows about that. Dust, runoff. Methane, which is now, you know, speaking of carbon trading and carbon credits, this is going to become a bigger and bigger issue. Leachate, ammonia, flies, how much land it takes. With BSE, which is mad cow disease, everyone's worried about biosecurity of manure. If you're walking in it, then walking to another facility, it's a big worry. Of course, the public relations. It just keeps going. You can see there's just a kind of a comprehensive list of things that have to happen because of a confined animal feeding operation, which is what a CAFO is. And in this particular case, we're talking about theirs. So a lot of folks have been looking at anaerobic digestion as an answer to their manure troubles. And in some cases, it helps them. And some of the things that it does address is this reduction of methane, reduces some of the solids by bulk density. So you have a tonnage reduction. You have a real consistent end product on a per digester basis. There are tax credits available, renewable incentives, digester carbon credits, all kinds of things that happen that are good with anaerobic digestion. But there is a slew of things that anaerobic digestion does not address. Doesn't minimize liquid. Does not reduce the volume of manure. Reduces the bulk density, but does not reduce the volume. It does not create an end product necessarily for this material raw. It must be further processed into something else. The handling labor that happens after the residuals are created. It doesn't reduce ammonia. As a matter of fact, you create more ammonia when you use an anaerobic digester. So there's a lot of things, and until recently, there's not been anyone really worrying about these kind of things. The pitch has been put an anaerobic digester, solve your electricity problems, put all your manure in one contained area, and that'll solve most of your issues, but it's just simply not true. Which is why, just kind of a little statistic here, AgStar, which is the partnership between the EPA and the USDA, keeps track of how many digesters and how they're doing and the success and failure rates. There's been about 200 digesters installed in the United States since 1998. They have a 14% failure rate, so that means 28 of those units have failed. And that's outright failure. They've closed down, they filled it with material, the thing caved in, or something of that nature. So it's a large percentage of failure. But we're on the kind of bleeding edge of some technology here, so it's not really that uncommon for things way out there to struggle. But in this particular case, everyone has been behind anaerobic digestion and said, we have to make this happen. We got to contain this cow manure. And some of the things that David was saying in the last talk were really opened my eyes about. I already know kind of what's stewing in the background, but it's just a matter of time. So this is a comparison to show you anaerobic digestion. It's the process in which microorganisms break down biodegradable material without oxygen. Right out of the peatmoss.com website, says it's a largely residue of plants and completely decomposed through lack of oxygen. So you can kind of see they're very similar. Anaerobic digestion and peat. And in theory, peat is made in an anaerobic digested over centuries environment underwater, which would be mostly anaerobic. So in the case of a bog, you have a large body of water with some fiber growing. Plant matter submerged underwater and anaerobic conditions developing slowly for centuries. The concept of a digester is not that much different. It's you're basically putting material into these tanks or these bunkers, submerging them, putting them in an anaerobic condition, but you're intentionally decomposing them quickly for usually around 30 days. So it's not identical, but it's similar in a lot of ways. You've got fiber underwater for some period of time. So the biogas companies need a more complete strategy, because of the list of items that you saw that are not addressed by anaerobic digestion. But a facility out of compliance due to residuals mishandling decreases the long-term viability of the project. We went to a project in Texas. Some of you might remember it was a microgene facility in Steamboat, Texas. And we were so excited about that project. We went down there, we set up some demonstration, and we went to work. Before long, they started having problems with financials, for sure, but one of their tanks was below the top. And when we first got there, all the manure was just running off the back. It was like as if no one even considered what to do at the end of the system. And it looked like just a giant lava flow of manure down toward the estuary. And so when we got there, they were happy to see us, obviously, but that was what was putting them at risk, was their operations, their facility, the giant lava flow. But that mishandling puts them in a really bad position, especially with the Texas TCEQ. Neighbors, of course, can still be plagued with dust and odors, even with a biogas plant. But now, with natural gas prices down around 2 to 250 million BTU, when we started this in 2006, 7, 8, it was up as high as 14. And, I mean, I remember thinking 7. Oh, good, stop at 7. Because that's the viability of a financial aspect of the plant before we did that. A plan that does not include this exporting of residuals of some sort contributes to the nutrient overload. So in a dairy who says we're going to put in a digester, but we're going to use all this material for our own fields and our own bedding. Well, they just end up recirculating a lot of this material back around and back around. So our comment has been, and our kind of our rail that we ride on, is export, export. Send that material to somebody who wants it. There are people in Yakima County, there are a group of tree companies, orchardists, who call us and say, how much you got? And I say, 7,000 tons. And they say, ship it to us. And they just can't get enough if it's manufactured correctly, if it's made right, and it's gone through all of its requirements. And I'm talking about compost, generally speaking. They will take it. But you have to go find the market that matches. You can't just export it to someone because that's what you have. They want what they want. And so the goal is to try to make them a product that they can use. And anaerobic digestion almost does nothing to address phosphorus, salt, and ammonia. I mean, we all know salt doesn't go anywhere. Ammonia is concentrated in the course of digestion. And these are all, every one of those items. And there's a long list. But depending on where you're at in the United States of America, it could be neighbors, it could be salt, it could be phosphorus, it could be nitrogen. It could be all or any of those things. And by containing it in a digester, you are able to at least make a better case and hopefully pull some revenue on it. This is these are three demonstration plants we did. As a matter of fact, this is the I would say infamous, Steamboat, Texas plant. And we made some pretty good fiber down there. This was our first plant over in Tillamook, Oregon, we did a demonstration. This was in Rupert, Idaho. Okay, here I'll just give you. This is a 66% closure ratio among digesters. These guys are gone, these guys are gone. So we've invested a lot of time and energy into this market, but it's been super, super frustrating. It was almost our doom in about 2009, because we had, before the economy went the way it did, we had invested a lot of time and energy and mental, physical, financial capital into this project, and it was a big disappointment that we could not get the project off the ground until 2010. So 2010, we launched our first commercial repeat facility. It's not been perfect, but it's been pretty great. We started loading these vessels, and the way this works is simply kind of an ag bag style system. They're specially made for this job, and composting in an ag bag is not necessarily anything new. People have been composting in ag bags for a while, and those of you that ever run across that, it used to be called gag bags. One of the reasons why is they have a tendency to go anaerobic, and these vessels just want to hold water and make trouble if you're trying to do composting. So we learned some things. We're able to take this digester fiber that's on the digester that you can't see in this scene. We bring the fiber down, we put it in our vessels, and we maintain temperature and keep track of what's happened and the pressure we use to load bags and things like that. This has been a pretty good facility. Again, some things we are still learning. I don't think that's ever going to quit. We're probably 85% of the way there on the product that we want. There's a couple areas we're still working on. I don't think, like I say, that's going to come anytime soon. We're continually working on improving it. Someone asked me about this the other day. I just want to show you. So someone asked about processing in the winter. And I thought, this picture truly just paints 1,000 words. So here it is. This is one of our vessels at 160 degrees in the middle of winter. It's zero outside. And there's ice coming off the bottom. So we can process year-round in these vessels, and that's, from a dairy standpoint, that's good. It's all contained inside our vessel. Ultimately, from the end user or the buyer's standpoint, this is good, because we're making a sterilized product at a high enough temperature to make a safe product for delivery. So we've had customers run tests, we run tests. Some of them are great, some aren't so great, but we're trending toward consistency now in our repeat testing. I wanted to put this up, it doesn't really help me that much, but I want you to kind of see what's happening. So peat, as everyone knows, is over 90% organic matter. The cation exchange is how it's interesting. We do a little better in that department. I'm not sure why, but it seems like we are able to pull nutrients. Hydration index was considered excellent. We're a little lighter, which is surprising. I'm not sure why that is, but that's what the lab sent us. Unless we happen just to get a heavy batch of peat.
Is that sphagnum peat?
It was.
Reed said.
No, it was sphagnum. And what I did so that I wasn't twisted it anyway. I just went to the store, bought some, opened it up, took a chunk, put it in a bag, set it up with my stuff, just to see what would happen. Of course, the pH came back nice and low on the peat. And this is actually a little on the low side for us. We have a tendency to run about 7.5, maybe sometimes even higher. This has been, we're waiting for some things to happen here. And expansion is most of it. We think we've developed the concept to solve that and get this down to about 6.8, which is where we'd like to go. But you can see our salt level is high, comparatively. And this is basically salt-free. But one of the things that we've been talking a lot about is, what is a salt? And so some of those salts are nutrient salts. And, you know, I like the lab, and I'm glad they do this. This particular test is consistent. But they've been introducing this new concept called EC5. EC5, which is their new salt testing, and it's all over the place. And we actually get a worse test because we have more organic matter. It's kind of a long story, but I called the lab and I said, how is it that I can take stuff that I know is 20 decisiemens per meter and compare it to our stuff? And it's not that far apart. And he said, well, that's because we're using EC5. And I said, well, yeah, but why should that matter? Isn't that even a test? And he said, well, the more organic matter you have, the more your EC5 will show a higher salt content. And this was out of soil control labs, I'll just tell you, out of Watsonville. And I thought, well, I don't know how to answer that question. But there's some discrepancy on the EC5. You'll see that comes up in a little bit. A C to N, we're significantly lower. I don't know if that's good or bad. Depends on who you're talking to. Fine fraction, we're a little lower, and we have a pretty good medium fraction. And there's, of course, the difference between the coarser fraction. That's been one of the things that we get a lot of feedback about is our product is coarser than a lot of the peat that most people order. I don't order peat. I don't really know. I can't really compare that, but that seems to be kind of a standard answer about our product. So we've done multiple growth trials. This one here is a one we did. Northern Lights Analytical did it for us out of Seattle area. And I just took pictures and stuck them on there. I mean, I think, you know, if I'm taking pictures, of course, I'm taking the best pictures, right? That's what I'm doing. So you can see, but I think that if you put all these plants together, you would see that it's virtually the same. It's virtually the same. I've had a couple discussions here, you know, over the last day and a half. And it sounds like, based on the people I talked to that are here, who have tested our product, say, yeah, that's about right. That's the kind of results we get, too, when we run demos of your product. And I just go to the bag, open it up, shove it into a box, and mail it out for the administration. So,
reception at 6 right now.
It seems to be doing okay.
Reception at 6 right
now. So, but there are some market realities, and I just want to make this as transparent as I can. Repeat as a peat alternative has got all kinds of potential, primarily because there's a huge volume of material. And we've been talking about, I mean, I had a guy who was just pestering me. Some of you guys know this guy. I won't say his name, about bringing in a product from Mexico, turning it into a peat alternative. I'm like, why would you do that when there's product right here and it's managed correctly, turning it into a peat alternative? And so I'm not against that, but I'm just saying, well, why would you do it when you have a product that is a waste? So independent testing has proven that we can be a viable peat partner. The reason I say that is I don't think we're anywhere near 100% peat replacement. I mean, I think that's a great goal of ours. We'd love to do that. We got to continue to prove ourselves over time. And that's fine. Digester economics have slowed because of the things we've talked about. But in our case, we had a plan to roll out 20 to 25 plants across the country. And all we need are these projects to work. And the digester guys are just having a hard time getting traction. And so we're trying to be patient and wait. There's nothing else we can really do. The economics of shipping was repeat and it's viable. It's within 150 miles. And part of our model was based on instead of shipping it across continent, you would create a resource that is in your neighborhood, local dollars, local labor, less hauling, all right there in your community. So we've tried to overlap maps of where are needs for large quantities of peat, where are there large confined animal feeding operations, where are the energy rates fairly good. And so it's kind of a complicated little grid, but we continue to work on it, and it is getting closer. Of course, we have higher salt and higher pH than the bog peat. Of course, that'll limit use. So where I said we might use 100% sphagnum moss peat. In our case, they're going to cut that down to 20% or something like that because of the impacts of salt and pH. Here's this comment about the ECE and the EC5. I had to put it in there just because it ticks me off. I had to put it in there. They have to be more clear. The composting council does not have a very good, they've not really resolved this issue. And I feel like I'm getting punished for doing a good job. I guess that happens in life. My kids get punished for doing a good job sometimes. We've been exploring storing in bales, but not to the point where we can bale it and do a test. We're just now running through the economics of what does it look like. But we've never shipped a bale of repeat. And we think there's probably some unforeseen impacts. Things like, mold. What kind of things will happen with moisture? When you take that material and press it down and stick it into a vessel, is it going to volatilize? I mean, your C-down ratio is 15:1. So potentially we create some more ammonia. So a guy opens a bag and a gallon smells like ammonia. It's not a very good sales pitch. So those are all things we have to address. And that's all possible. And then lastly, we have to show growing media users that managed manure can be reliable and safe. To offset years of manure caused grower headaches. Okay, I gotta do it. Raise your hand if you've had headaches because of bad manure in your mix. Ever. Nobody. You're not raising your hands. There's several places in Oregon where people have taken manure, mixed it in, blended it in, killed a bunch of plants out of nursery. There's a lot of those stories. And I don't want those. I don't want those on my back. So we want to make sure we do the best job we can. There's a lot of disappointing stories out there for people, especially who are in nursery stock. So how might repeat help the business? We can produce it, of course, like we said, much closer to U.S. clients. More flexible on delivery. It is a byproduct of renewable energy. This makes for a pretty good story. It's made from a waste, again, another piece of a good story. Once the facility is established, we don't really have any significant worry about weather because everything's in a vessel. So it's all managed. It gets rained on or snowed on or iced on. We really don't care too much because it's all in the bag. So once the facility is established, we have an ongoing containment system for this product. So weather, generally, unless it's in that point where we're pulling it out of bags, loading into a truck, as long as we don't get huge rainstorms in that little window of time, we're in pretty good shape. Of course, shorter hauls mean a less fuel-based carbon impact. And some of this stuff, I don't know. I mean, there's people who would say to you, by having a tractor, having a loader, and you're just carbon, carbon, carbon. I just don't know. But it just seems like if you have to make something locally and ship it locally, but that's got to be a much better story from the standpoint of carbon. Long-term agreements can act like leases. One of the things that we were discussing earlier is we want to make sure that we are not stuck trying to follow the commodities market. And one of the ways that we can do that is by having 10-year agreements. And why would anyone sign a 10-year agreement? Because most of these energy contracts are 10-year agreements. So if you want to go put up an anaerobic digester, the power company won't give you a 1-year agreement or a 2-year agreement. They're going to want to do a 5- or 10-year agreement. And selfishly speaking, that's good for us. It gives us a long supply, a 10-year supply of material, which, in theory, allows us to invest a lot more capital at that site because we know that we're going to be there for a while. So I like that component. The 10-year story is good. And finally, repeat seems to be working. So all of this is theoretical until does the product work? And right now, the product seems to be working. Again, there's going to be a continual movement toward how do we improve it, how do we improve it. You guys remember these things? I remember when I was growing up, my dad worked at a mill down in Sheridan, Oregon. He was a timber buyer and then also did some stuff to help. And I remember seeing these all the time, operating, smoky as all get out, and there was burning sawdust, okay? I mean, everyone who's ever been near a lumber or timber industry sees. And And this is what they look like now. I don't know if any of them that are burning sawdust anymore. I mean, that seems like, that would be just an amazing thing to see someone burn sawdust to get rid of it. By the way, I think this is interesting. A tree growing from the middle of it. I don't know what that means, but probably some symbolism. So TV burners were used to burn mill waste up until the 1970s. When they were burning, they produced large quantities of smoke and ash. Now, back then, no one really thought much about it, which was vented directly in the atmosphere without any scrubbing or any cleaning, contributing to poor air conditions wherever they were used. Now, I pulled this off of someone who was talking about this specifically, and you'll see where this is going. As a result, environmental laws regarding air pollution, specifically the Clean Air Act, put all the TV burners out of business by about 1980. And I was thinking back in my head, yeah, I haven't really seen those running for years. I mean, I can't remember the last time I saw one. And most everyone that I see looks just like that. So at this point in the manure revolution, something is going to have to change. The idea of spreading manure and applying manure randomly to fields or over-applying manure. I want to insert a little story right here. So Yakima County is considered nationally what they call an environmental justice county. And I don't know how much you've heard about that, but it essentially comes down to that bad dairy guys are polluting the soil so they can harm the people who are poor. That's the short version. But the environmental justice concept is to come in and say, hey, you know, we got to clean this up. Now, there's a lot of concern and question about, are the dairies really doing it? What about the guys who are using commercial fertilizers for the 50 years prior until the dairies arrived? But one of the things they use a lot, they really like to talk about the blue baby syndrome, and you might have heard this phrase, blue baby syndrome, caused by nitrates in the groundwater. So I just had to know, I typed in blue baby syndrome. Started searching on Google, and I searched, and I searched, and I searched, and I searched. And I have never found an incident of blue baby syndrome. But the EPA talks about it like there's, you know, there's blue babies everywhere. But I cannot find one incident. And if you find one, please send it to me, because I'm trying to find one. So you would think that would be just an obvious thing. Regardless of if they can make their case against dairies or not, the way that dairies handle the manure is absolutely going to change. It just can't continue this way. So regardless of where you fall on the environmental scale, a dairy who produces manure in a wasteful way has got to manage it. I mean, the waste that I produce at my house, I have to manage it. The waste that a business produces, they have to manage it. And for me, it's not a political football. It's, hey, if you have 5,000 cows and you're making a bunch of manure, do something productive with it. Don't just put it on the fields and cross your fingers and hope it doesn't cause trouble. So I can imagine myself in 2040 when I'm about 76 years old. Here's what the discussion will sound something like. That's right, grandson, back in the year 2000, they used to manage their manure by spreading it around the fields with these large, these things called manure spreaders. When they were spreading, they produced this large quantity of dust and odor, which was vented directly into the atmosphere. You sound familiar? On the page before. Without any sort of scrubbing or cleaning, contributing to poor air, water, and soil conditions wherever they were used. As a result, environmental laws regarding air pollution, the EPA Clean Air Act of 2018, I just picked that randomly, put all the spreaders out of business by about 2022. Now, I mean, this is just kind of, you know, Russ Davis's fanciful concept of what might happen here. But I do believe that is the trend. And there is an opportunity in this trend to do something with this problem. And those of you who have ears to hear, you're saying to yourself, 10-year agreements, a steady supply, large quantities, and it's not going to go anywhere. It's not as if you're going to get a contract for trees that are going to be taken out, that you're going to grind up into a product that you can use that is gone in a few years, or the contract sold, or the land has now changed hands. As long as a dairy can stay in business, and the trend for large-scale dairies is this way, the trend for small dairies is this way. It's, I mean, if you have a chance to go to the National Agricultural Statistics website, it's kind of shocking to see how many. I mean, there was 100,000 little dairies just a few years ago, and now there's about 55,000. I mean, if you're under 500 cows, the trend is just like this. But the animal numbers haven't changed much. They're now all starting to be confined in these larger and larger facilities where there's more and more product. And it has to be addressed. So, where to go from here? It seems to me that there's a great opportunity to take a product, a byproduct, really, and turn it into a product. There's a lot of science that needs to be invested into this concept. We have, as you know, kind of a rinky-dink compost company out of Washington State, we spend a lot of time and energy trying to develop the repeat concept, and it's really, rinky-dink's a good word. I mean, we're just not that big of a company, and you know, we spend our lives in Calumet. And if I had known, I might not have picked Calumet 10 years ago. That's my lifelong dream. But there is an unfathomable amount of material that can be turned into something of value, and it's not going to go away. And there's going to be more. And if we can figure out collectively, as people who are in the soil amendments business, how to manage it in such a way so that we can utilize it to create a product that the customer likes, then we got something. And I know there's a lot of guys in this room already who are working on this kind of stuff, and there's a lot of potential out there. But we think the repeat's got some traction. And what's next for us is to try to find additional facilities. So we're on the hunt. If you know of a large-scale digester that has too much fiber and is looking for someone to talk to, please send them to us. And we're aggressively pursuing these things. And we would like to see ourselves put 20 or 30 of these plants in over the course of the next hour long. By the way, the system is called Fiberite. That turns into repeat. It's a patented system. It uses a lot of technology that's kind of off the shelf that we put together. But there's absolutely a potential for dairy fiber to be used as a peat alternative, but there's a lot of work to do. But it's begun. We're on our way. Thank you.
We have any questions?
Yes, sir.
For us, you didn't mention anything that I didn't see in cost. I mean, a price for a cubic foot of repeat versus a cubic foot of peat.
How much would you like? Comparatively, our model has been to kind of index the peat. One of the things that we have more of is manufacturing costs. Once a bog is established, I mean, I assume the cost of the actual fiber from the bog is pretty minimal. It's all the stuff manufactured and handled at home. In our case, we do have to share some revenue with the dairy. So I suspect in the end, it's going to be about a push. We might be a little under the price of peat. The way we see ourselves entering the market is that way. I mean, it's going to be hard for us to come in and say, hey, we've got some challenges here, here, and here. We'd like to charge you more than what you currently have that you can rely on that you've been using for 30 years. So I suspect in the end, the prices are going to be comparable. Maybe especially, you know, when I think we have to be indexed. I do.
So what you're saying is today they're not.
No, they are comparable. Yeah, I think that we're selling repeat at Washington State.
Okay.
And we are less than the cost of peat. But we're kind of, you know, we're exploring with our customers, and they know it's not perfect, and they're willing to say, we'll share the risk with you, continue to improve. And when it'll stand on its own as a 100% peat alternative, I think the economics will make more sense. Yes, sir.
How does it age? Does it shrink like peat, or does it maintain as well?
In the case of when you put it in a vessel, that's a good question. When you put it in a vessel like that, because we're not manually managing it like a returner, the structure is pretty well preserved. We see about a 15% reduction, like you would separated solids compost or something like that, and it goes from here to here. And since we're trying to keep the value up and produce enough of the volume of product, and at least in my mind, the more we can retain the value of the structure and the volume of the better. So, the review. So, I would say we have about a 20% reduction. And it's not much. When you look out and see that brand new bag, what you normally notice is the bag goes from this to this. It actually has changed shape. But we've not seen a significant reduction in the volume.
So, So from the point of being market ready to being in a bag for 2 months, is it really compact, or does it maintain the majority of its volume?
You have to ask the customer, because I've never really asked that specific question.
Peat shrinks great time.
Is it?
Yeah.
Mostly settling.
Don't sit next to the peat guy.
Peat's got a problem. He shrinks. Sorry.
Yes, sir.
So, yeah, let me ask, I'm trying to understand something. So you're really aggravating to the producer that you sell to.
I like you were saying, that's Steve. I personally just aggravate.
Yeah. Well, no, my point is you're cheaper on the West Coast because you're coming at your bulk versus coming from Canada and bales on a per cubic foot basis. That's what I heard you said.
That's right.
Number one. Number two, if you sell it to me and I'm going to use it, I've got to put it undercover again, otherwise if I'm in a rainy area, what does that do to me?
That's right.
Okay.
But however, you do have the ability to do just-in-time delivery also. So you call me and we need four loads.
Okay.
And we ship them to you. And that's the perfect scenario. And that way, and one of the benefits...
Are you coming out of the bag at that point? Or
what's that?
Are you coming out of your bag at that point?
It usually comes out of a bag and it's just staged until it gets loaded in the truck. But not very long. I mean, one of the problems we have, just to be honest, one of the problems we have at the Ruger site is the site's too small. And he goes, there's the site, that's what you get. And I said, well, it's about an acre too small. So we're constantly having to move material through there, which means we have to stage it. I don't like staging. I like to leave it in the bag. So on an ongoing basis, new facilities will have additional real estate just for that reason. So we open a bag, we pull it out, we stage it for half a day or a day, and out it goes. And then if it's raining, just don't harvest that day. So we do have the ability to kind of work around the weather.
What's your bone dry percent and moisture percent? How do you measure
it? All of our tests are coming back in the neighborhood of 50% wet. But here's what's interesting about it is, and this is a testing question, and I'm unable to completely uncover, but on a percentage basis, because there is less density of that material, I can take the exact same batch of material that feels about the same, looks about the same as far as moisture, that is compost, and send it out for a lab test with repeat. The compost will come back at a lesser percentage because there's more fiber and more stuff, including ash and whatever else is in there, versus over here. So the percentage is higher. But it doesn't feel, I mean, you can't squeeze water out of it. It's kind of an odd deal. I don't know if peat is the same thing, but like, it says, 55%, but you can't squeeze water out of it. I don't know, I mean, that's a little, technically, I don't know why it's that way.
Your hydration index you were using, was that the testing wettability? What it takes up for?
It's re-wetting.
Okay, well, how does it... there's no hydrophobicity or any water repellency? Does it just suck up water?
When it's bone dry, I've seen it bone dry next to peat, it's less hydrophobic than peat, but it's not like, at least from my view, it's not shocking. I mean, you'd still have to add some level of surfactant, I'm guessing. And the guys who are buying it now, you have to ask them, but I don't know about that piece of it. Yes, sir.
Did you say that you share the revenue with the dairy?
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. The dairy is providing us a piece of land. They're also providing us with, depending on the relationship, they're providing us with fuel, maybe some loaders and some other equipment. There's kind of a perceived value to a dairyman, especially as bedding, that it has an intrinsic use on the dairy side. That value seems to be in the $4 to $5 per yard range to the dairy. I mean, in that range. It kind of depends where you're at.
As just raw manure?
Yeah, just to them as is.
Okay.
Now, we pay them based on material that's shipped, not material that's manufactured. But they perceive that I can use it as bedding. It's worth $4 or $5 a yard, and they're right. But they have to be bedding. So the guys are putting them in water beds. I don't know what they're doing. That'll be a little more easy to work with. Yes, sir.
You're producing electricity off the process?
Yeah, in our case, our process does not, but the digester behind this does. And it can do one of several things. It can either make electricity that is sold to the power company. They can take natural gas and inject it right into a pipeline that's green gas. And it's just methane. It's all the same pretty much. Also clean that up. Or they can compress it. I mean, one of the new things now is to compress it and try to make fuel for moving around the dairy. And that's a pretty good model. There's a company in Indiana who's doing that right now. And they seem to like that because the way they've established is they have natural gas going to this location, and they use dairy gas. But if they run low, they can switch over to natural gas. And it's a pretty clever concept. And they're now starting to haul milk using the same concept. So they go a long distance down. For example, there's some guys from Indiana to Tennessee, and they realize they can only get a portion of the way down before they run out of gas. So they start establishing these fueling stations that are on the route that are natural gas fueling stations. So even though they're leaving on dairy gas on the way out of there, they can fill up with natural gas the rest of the way. And I think in their minds, over the course of time, they'd like to establish more dairy gas at those fueling stations. But those are the three big ones. There's some other guys trying to make hydrogen and stuff like that, and fuel cells. And it's a long ways off. Right? So, yes, sir.
Did you say the process takes about 30 days from raw to finished?
In the case of Repeat, it's about 35 days. I think that if we institute some of the changes we're working on, we might get into a month. But that would be really pushing.
Can you grind any more than the 55 that you talked about earlier?
We've been talking about that. It's possible. The only reason we haven't done it so far is because we ship it loose. And the most we can get into a truck is about 120 yards.
Yes.
In the truck, in the bulk truck. So to drive
at 55% moisture.
What's that?
At 55% moisture, you can load the truck.
Yeah, it's 700 pounds, 650 pounds per yard.
Is there much difference in the Repeat from corn-fed cattle versus grass-fed cattle?
We have not made Repeat from beef cattle. All that we've...
You can feed grass to it. Dairy cattle.
Yes. Most of the dairy cows are fed a very specific ration in order to accomplish whatever they're trying to do for production.
Okay.
And those rations are pretty consistent. That's one of the things we like about the dairy cow in our case. Is they know they need to get 75 pounds of milk, and to do that, they got to have this much protein, this much roughage, and this much nutrient, this much calcium. And so they're, even though they might mix and match feedstocks nationally, they're not that much different. Like rice hulls, you know, chaff, or something like that.
Thank you, Russ.